You're listening to KRUU LP 100.1 FM, the voice of Fairfield, Iowa, and beyond. Grassroots listener-supported solar-powered radio broadcasting live from the Cultural District here in sunny Fairfield, Iowa. And this is Writers' Voices with Monica and Caroline. I'm your host, Monica Hadley, and with me is my co-host and mother, Caroline Kilborn.
And good afternoon, everyone, or good morning, as the case may be, if you're listening on Monday. It is a beautiful day today, and I'm hoping it'll be that on Monday, too. We are having a tremendous weather this summer. I don't know how we managed to do it, but we did.
I know. It's sort of, I feel like, you know, global warming and climate change is a problem, but I kind of like the way the climate is changing here. So we have a really interesting guest today.
We do.
I've always been a fan of historical fiction. I enjoy reading it. In my blog post about the show today, which you can see at KRUUFM.com, I write about how historical fiction allows the reader to really experience another life and time in a way.
That's right.
In a really intense way sometimes.
And this was a time, the time of this is set is a time when the world was in turmoil. The world was in turmoil.
Absolutely.
Yeah. With Mussolini and Hitler and everybody.
So why don't you introduce our guest today?
Okay, our guest today is Victoria Shore, and she's a writer and political activist. She lived in Brazil for 10 years. Currently, she lives in Los Angeles, where she co-founded the Archer School for Girls and is now working to found a college prep school for the girls on the Pine Ridge Indian Reservation. That's a great endeavor. It really is.
And the title of her book is Backlands.
Yes,
Backlands. And it is the story of a couple of bandits.
Yeah, right. Well, basically a young woman, who joins this band of bandits, and the life is hard there. Life is very hard because it drought, terrible drought.
Very interesting. Well, welcome to Writer's Voices, Victoria.
Thank you so much.
And as Caroline just pointed out, you know, the drought is really almost another character.
I mean, it really
book.
Is. It
yeah.
Was, it's kind of a defining aspect of the region there.
It certainly is.
People fear it. They've all experienced. They experience drought. They wait for it. They're afraid of it. I once walked up on someone's porch out there with mud on my shoes, and I apologized for it. And they said, "No, it's beautiful. Where was the water?"
Oh,
wow. Yeah. And now, of course, you're in California now, which is experiencing
it's
drought.
Ironic that here we are with a drought, but of course. You know, in L.A., you hardly know it. I walk by my neighbors who are watering their lawns, and I'm thinking, oh, my gosh, you know, what are you doing?
I thought they weren't allowed to water their lawns.
I did, too. I don't get it. But it really hasn't affected anyone yet, whereas out there, it affects everyone all the time. You know, you're so much closer to the reality of nature. Here we're still insulated. You know, we still turn on the taps and water comes out.
Right.
There, a lot of times to get water, I would see people walking with the great big buckets on their heads, you know, carrying from the rivers.
And how recently was that?
Well, it was, the last time I was there was about 10 years ago. Things had changed a lot, but in the late 80s and early 90s, that's the way it was.
Wow.
Where? And there was no electricity in a lot of the places, so.
You know, we think of Brazil as being lush, you know, with
the rainforest.
We do, and
most of Brazil is lush. And you start at the coast, you know, we think of beaches and palm trees and Amazon, you know. But this is a part of Brazil that even Brazilians don't know that much about. It's inland from, in the northeast of Brazil, you know, a lot of people know where Salvador is in Bahia. You know, you would fly to Bahia or Recife and then drive inland for half a day. As I say in the book, on a bad road getting worse.
Yeah.
Before long, you're in another world. You're in a world that is practically biblical. You know, it's just extraordinary. People are different. I traveled with another woman, a photographer, who knew the region, a Brazilian, who'd been traveling out there for years. And We never saw another car in four different trips that we took.
Now, this is not your usual tourist destination. What drew you to this area of the world?
Oh, there were no tourists. In fact, it was always a challenge about, well, where are we going to sleep tonight? Oftentimes, people would have, a room or two in their houses for traveling salesmen or something like that, that kind of thing.
Wow. So did you ever end up camping out?
You know, we didn't, thank goodness. One night, we're going to have to sleep on a park bench in a village near on the San Francisco River. And, I mean, it really was a bad feeling. You know, we were kind of looking at the bench and, but then they opened up the town hall for us.
Nice.
We slept in a room where Don Pedro II, the last emperor, had once slept. It was a far cry from the park bench, but...
So why were you there?
Pardon me, why?
Yes.
Well, I had gotten interested in these bandits. We were living in Brazil. Then we were both, we had been living in New York. My husband is also a writer, and he had just written a book on exploration with old photos from the Natural History Museum he'd found there in New York. So some Brazilian friends had asked us to come down and see a ranch that he had, and so we thought, we had just had a child. New York was kind of falling to pieces in those days. So we thought, let's get out and go to Brazil, excuse me, for a year. So we went, we put all of our things in, excuse me.
Bless you.
Pollen, in storage in New York, and went to Brazil for a year, and 10 years later came back with two more children and worries.
Wow.
But I had heard about these bandits. I heard their song, actually, which was to the women of the Sertão of the region, you teach me to make lace, and I'll teach you to make love. And I thought, wow, what's this? So I started researching them a little bit, and I found some poetry, and I thought, these are bandits who are more interesting than the usual run-of-the-mill. I mean, they were actually seeking justice in their region. They weren't just criminals. They weren't criminals at all, really.
No.
They were kind of the Robin Hood.
They were Robin Hood,
that's
exactly.
Right.
And I thought, wow,
men.
What an opportunity to really see
right.
this. Now, they were active in the 20s and 30s, but when I went there in the late 80s and early 90s, every village I went to had people who still remembered them, the old people. I mean, it was such a gift. It was extraordinary.
Wow.
But but bandits are no longer active there, right?
No, they're not. They're not. They they were born in the late 1800s. You know, I think he was born in maybe 89, 1899. They're not active. It's funny, right before World War II, Brazil had a change of government, and they were decided to modernize a bit, so they went after them.
Power
structure in the region too, which up until then were colonels, what they called colonels, kind of big landowners who controlled their own regions. It was almost a feudal.
Yeah, that's what region. It sounds like.
Yeah.
Well, it was interesting how many people, even some policemen, were his friends, the bandits' friends.
Well, yeah. That's how it worked. You know, there were certain colonels who were on the same side of the justice divide that they were, who were maybe a shadow government outside of power.
Uh-huh.
And so they would protect them. They would let them camp on their lands. They would provide them with food and bullets and guns, and no one could touch them when they were on their land. Mm-hmm. So they had a real support system throughout the region. And people liked them. People liked them a lot. They were funny and smart and fair.
Well, they weren't cruel. I noted they really weren't cruel.
They weren't cruel. They weren't cruel. They had their, they had their rules and they followed them.
And yet they did kill people.
They did kill people.
Yeah.
They absolutely did. If someone betrayed them to the police, they would kill them. They would come back and kill them.
And yet they said, "Don't die for us."
If one of their They had a system of suppliers through the region, and if the police went to torture some of them, their instructions were, tell them no problem, tell them where we are. They still won't get us. Tell them where you helped us, the information you have. It won't matter. But that was different from actively going out and betraying them.
Right, right.
And, the police were really worse than the bandits. They were much crueler. They were much more repressive, unfair. They would sweep into a place, and anyone that they thought was helping the bandits, they would murder, they would torture. I mean, it really was a bad thing.
You know, without even asking them in a couple cases.
Yeah, no, exactly. It really was.
Yeah.
It was intense, you know. It was an intense time in an intense region, and in a way, it still is. You know, people there have hard lives, but they also have a lot of fun. They have these fabulous festivals. June, they have a great swarm up called for St. John's Day, which we don't really celebrate here, but it's very big in Latin America, San Juan, and everybody dresses like kind of country bumpkins and sets off fireworks, and it's a lot of fun, even in the big cities.
So you started researching this in the 1980s?
I did, in the late 80s and early 90s. And then around 92, we moved back to America. We moved to L.A., and I got, you know, I did have children during that time. I had these three small children, which, as one of my friends, quite an old woman now, who is a painter, said, children take concentration and painting takes concentration, so I had to wait for the children to grow up till I started painting. It's kind of my situation, too. You know, we had the children, and when I moved to L.A., it was interesting. You know, when you've been away for a long time, you come back, and I saw sort of more visible wealth on Sunset Boulevard, really, than I'd seen in Latin America, and I thought, gosh, this town could really support a girls' school that could be for all the girls of L.A., that could be half scholarship, half financial aid. So I got involved in starting this school, the Archer School for Girls. Now there are 500 girls there from, I think, 96 zip codes. It's a great thing, but it took a lot of time.
Yeah, I'll bet.
It took a lot of time and work. So then once that was done, I could really go, and then my children were in high school and college, and I could go back to my writing, and that's when I really focused on this book.
So is Backlands your first published fiction?
It's my first published book. It's not my first book, but it's my first published book.
Wow. And once you got back to it, how long of a process was it?
I think about 5 or 6 years, because what happened was, I was writing other things in the meantime as well, but it was hard to figure out the structure for this book. I was originally planning to write a nonfiction account because, by the way, everything in the book is true. To me, it is nonfiction, although it is a novel because I do go into the characters' heads. But I was planning a nonfiction account, but I realized I had to give so much information because nobody here knows about the Sertão, and they don't know really much about Brazil in a way, don't know about the bandits. So all of a sudden I found myself with a very boring account, and I had to reconceive it, and then I came up with what I hope is a fun way to tell it.
It took
a lot of rewriting. I mean, there were moments when I thought, I must be out of my mind, you know.
Did you ever get tired of the story?
I didn't get tired of the story, but I despaired about my ability to tell it.
Mm. Did you identify with Maria Bonita?
Not too much. You know, I didn't identify with her. She was kind of more headstrong than I am.
Mm.
You know? She walked out of a marriage. I don't know if I'd have the courage to do what she did. I admire her, though. I really admire her. You know, she was in a terrible marriage. She was married to a man that, an older man, she didn't even know him, practically. He never touched her. They had a completely loveless marriage. And she walked out, but she was safe, and she was fed, which in those days, people starved to death. You know, even when we moved to Brazil in the early 80s, there was a terrible drought up there, and millions of people starved to death.
Oh, my.
It barely even made news. We were reading the Brazilian news, trying to learn Portuguese, reading the Brazilian newspaper and saying to each other, is this what we're reading? You know, people are starving to death.
Wow.
500 miles from here.
Now, when you went back to the book, went back to writing the book after coming back to the U.S. and finishing your other projects, did you make any more trips to Brazil to research at that point?
I have many, because I was also writing for a magazine that would send me down there to do really fun articles. I would write about, I wrote about Sebastião Salgado's reforestation project. I wrote about a prostitutes union, which I thought was really revolution, you know, a new world. I wrote about a lot of other women's issues.
Wow.
So that was really great. So, and whenever I would go into the Sertão and make a visit. There's also another amazing incident that happened out there 40 years earlier than the bandits that I want to write about next. And I had graduated from Wellesley College, and I got a grant from them to go down and study this next religious uprising in the 1890s that I want to write about next. It took place in this same region.
Oh, fascinating.
Yeah.
And this is, you know, pretty much a largely ignored in terms of popular culture in the U.S., the whole region.
In the U.S. and even in Brazil, people don't know about this. Last night we had an event here in L.A. at the Brazilian consulate that was filled with Brazilians and the ambassador and everyone, and they didn't really know the story in a serious way. The bandits had been made almost into cartoon characters down there, and it really took a foreigner to look at them as amazing, interesting, smart people.
Wow.
So it was really a lot of fun, though, I have to say, to travel out there and meet these people who'd known them. It just was incredible to me, really.
You're listening to Writers' Voices with Monica and Caroline, and our guest today is Victoria Shore, the author of Backlands. And it's just a wonderful story. And I'll have to say, I saw the New York Times review, the Sunday book review.
That was so wonderful.
Yeah. And, you know, it starts out that usually when reviewing a novel, you must be careful not to give away too much plot. But in the case of Victoria Shore's Backlands, there's no such danger. Shore herself reveals the bare bones of the story in the first few pages. So the whole time I'm reading this, I know how it ends, and I keep wishing that it has. I kept thinking maybe I was wrong. Maybe it will have a different ending.
I know. I've always felt the same way. Can't I do something? No. And, I don't want to say too much, but toward the end there are all these possibilities that could have gone differently.
Oh, yeah.
And they keep talking about it. Well, yeah, it, you know.
Now, some of those, were those documented that they actually happened? I know what you're referring to. It was.
They were documented by the very people who told about those survived and were interviewed in the 60s. By a professor from São Paulo who went up there, and he wrote a great book that's called Thus Died Lampião. This is how it happened. And he interviewed everyone. He interviewed people from both sides, all the cangaceiros, all the local people, all the police. It was just it is an amazing compilation. And
what a great resource for you.
Heavily on that.
Yeah.
Some of those testimonies. And then also from people that I interviewed. Most of the book is from firsthand interviews.
As you were interviewing, did you record the interviews? Did you
take notes? I wish I had. I don't know. You know, I'm so untechnological. I wish I'd even just taken Polaroids of the people. My friend was a photographer that I was with, but she is a very strict architectural photographer, and she only was interested in the houses and then the landscape. So I didn't record things except in my journals.
Oh, wow.
which is bad, but it's really the way I work. I still work that way. I even bought a recorder. I recently was interviewing Liz Holtzman in New York, and I have the recorder. I recorded it, but when I went to write the piece, I didn't use it. I really take my notes and kind of listen. I guess it's just a different way.
Now, the photograph on the front page, the front of the book, is that really Maria Bonita?
It is. It's wow. really Maria Bonita. And there are some wonderful photographs, because every time that they would go to a village when there weren't police around, there would be journalists who would photograph them. There are lots of photographs. They love to photograph them and write about them. Lots of articles, interviews, which are really fun as well, all of them in Portuguese.
Well, the interviews you conducted must have been in Portuguese also.
They were in Portuguese. And but, you know, we had lived down there by then for maybe 7 or 8 years.
So you were fluent?
Yeah, I did learn to speak Portuguese. It wasn't easy, but I did. And it would be easy.
And have you been able to maintain that your fluency?
We have, luckily, because we have so many Brazilian friends, both in L.A. and in Brazil, whom we stay in really close touch with.
Oh, wonderful.
And my younger son was just working down there for 2 years, so that was fun.
Oh, cool. And he was born there, right?
He was born there. He's a little half Brazilian, half American. Well, he's he's got two passports, which is fun. So does my daughter.
Wow.
So it was great. You know, an amazing thing that happened was a filmmaker actually traveled with the bandits for a while, and he shot footage of them, which a little bit exists. What happened was he was out there shooting, making a film. He was trying to make, quote, a real cowboy film. and he ran out of film. He went back to the village where he lived to get more film, and was shot by his, nobody knows if it was his wife's boyfriend or his girlfriend's husband.
Oh, right. Yeah, I remember that part.
Not in his underwear, a typical Brazilian situation. And the film was lost for 30 years.
Oh, golly.
And in the late 60s, someone found it in Salvador, Bahia, and it got down to a filmmaker, actually a Czech refugee filmmaker in São Paulo, and he they salvaged what they could, and so there's this about an 8-minute piece left of them, which is extraordinary to just really see them.
Wow. Now, has there been any interest expressed in making your book into a movie?
Well, people have talked about it. I'm not quite sure. Living in L.A., I should be the expert on this, how it works. But we'll see. Fingers crossed on that. It would be fun if they do a good job.
Yeah.
You never know.
Who would you cast as the leads?
Oh, gosh. it's really hard. I don't have an answer for that. I mean, do you have any thoughts? Bad at that.
I'd have to think about it, and I'm sorry to put you on the spot, but
no, not at all. Other people have asked me that, and I don't really have an answer, because I still think of them as the way they really, I know what they really look like,
and right,
it's like Americans. It's really a strange, they were a combination of Portuguese and native Brazilian Indian.
Mm-hmm.
And with some African Brazilian thrown in. They're really a very distinctive Brazilian mix. It's just a fabulous local.
All right, I could see maybe Zoe Saldana.
There we are.
As Maria.
Best idea yet.
Yeah.
Hey. Oh, that's great.
Oh. Well, the hero, he really was, his motivation in the beginning was revenge for these people just shooting his father for no reason.
His father. I mean, and it was justice. He went to court first.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah.
So important. I think that was such a,
yes,
for me, such an important piece of getting interested in the story, that he wasn't just a thug,
No.
His father was murdered by neighbors in cold blood. He was sitting on his cousin's porch. They came up and shot him. They actually got some police to come up and shoot him, even worse, and the cousin as well. Lampion, who was then still called Virgolino, which was his given name, went to court to try to get justice. And the judge said to him, look, your father's dead. There's nothing we can do for him now. The men who killed him are alive, and they can come back and kill us. So you're going to have to leave justice to God.
Yeah.
And that's what most people had to do out there, was just leave justice to God. But he decided that he wasn't the man to do that. He and his brothers joined a band. There was a very small band operating in the region at the time on their same side of the divide, of the neighboring feud. And they went out and joined that group. And then Lampion was such a good leader that before long there were 100 men in the group, you know, from like 30 to 100, and they were doing really well, and living this really, you know, really quite a wonderful life, quite a passionate life, you know, always on the run but free.
And for women in particular, freedom was not common.
Freedom was not common. Life out there was really, really hard. They were as often as not married off to people they didn't even know, basically, had no say in it.
Had tons of children, most of whom would die.
They would die young, or even die old at age 32, you know.
Yeah.
Is almost the way it was. I mean, I would, even today, I would meet people out there who looked so much older.
Mm.
Then one would think from the hard work.
Yeah.
They didn't have any say in their lives. The only fun they would have really was when the bandits would come to town and throw a dance for them. And
yeah.
Amazing.
No wonder the bandits were so popular.
They were so popular and protected, you know.
So I'm looking at the photograph of Lampeo in the book, and I think I know who could play him. Javier Bardem.
Oh, okay. That's great.
Yeah. He was in No
Always
Country
got the
for
hard
Old
part
Men.
Done.
Yeah.
Right. We've cast it.
Yeah.
But it's an intense story, and he would be great because he would understand the Latin piece.
Yeah.
So, Victoria,
why don't you read a little bit from Backlands?
I thought I'd start. And read a little bit from the beginning, just to set the place. And then I was going to read just one short, another piece about Maria Bonita, but right before she left with Lampion.
Okay?
All right. So the book is set in the region, it's called the Sertão. It's almost another country in the northeast of Brazil, separated from the rest by climate, by culture, by inclination even. Its boundaries are its own, parts of seven states, the hard parts, nothing like the rest. Semi-arid, a geographer could tell you, which means that you can raise a few cattle in a good year, goats most of the time, manioc and sisal if you're near a river, and that sooner or later a drought will send you running for your life. The people here know that. Every one of them has searched, first closely, then desperately, for clouds in the cloudless sky. They've gone down on their knees, whispered one-word prayers, flayed their own backs, cut off long, beautiful braids, for the virgin, for nothing, for rains that haven't come. And when the goats finally died, they've given up and gone to the coast, forever, where the sun is soft and life is easy, but they don't stay. They come back as soon as the rains do. They put on their leather and ride out across what now seems to them the kindest of lands, with every cactus, every thorn giving fruit. It's a strong taste, but they'll tell you they're accustomed, drawn to contradiction, bred for contrast. They stir great spoonfuls of sugar into the blackest coffee. The more they love someone, the farther away they dance. They hang the bleeding heart of Jesus on the walls beside their bull god, and their hero is the violent, courteous bandit Lampion. Forgive me, he would say as he robbed them. You understand, and they did. His story was their story. Feud, a murder, the usual wholesale lack of justice. But instead instead of turning the other cheek, as they did, he picked up a gun and joined a band of local outlaws, intending simply to kill the men who'd shot his father and then go home to his goats. But it turned out that he was too good at what he did to ever go home again. He was a natural leader, and his upbringing as a cowboy and a mule driver had given him a sense of the land that translated into an unerring sense of strategy. When authorities fought with him, he won. Word got out. Young men, brave and tough, and mostly carrying their own torch of grievance against a system that had been killing their brothers and fathers for generations, flocked to him. By 1925, he was leading the biggest gang of bandits in Brazil. He and his men roamed the Sertão almost at will. They could live even in the remote reaches of the Badlands, the way thorns do on drops of water, Lampion told a reporter. A jaguar came up to eat me once, but he thought I was a cactus and went away. What qualifications does a man need to join your band? The reporter asked him. Nothing much, Lampion shrugged. Just so long as he's agile as a cat, clever as a fox, can track like a snake, and disappear like the wind. Disappear like the wind, yes, of course, for how else could they escape so often? More than once, the police had the gang surrounded with no way out. Then they mapped the victory parades, called out the samba bands, and informed the press Lampion is dead. Even the New York Times printed it twice. Lampion collected those clippings. I'm used to dying, he liked to say. The people believed that he was a corpo fechado, a closed body, impervious to bullets, having been blessed by Padre Cicero, the local miracle priest. When he needed something, he would head for a town. His heralds would precede him. My people, here comes Lampion, in love with life and wishing you well. Receive him nicely and he's sweet rice pudding. Betray him and he's a rattlesnake. They rarely betrayed him. They gave him what he needed, guns, money, salt, ammunition. They trailed after him as he strolled through their streets, discoursing with their mayors, offering alms to their poor, praying in their churches. He would talk to them at length, tell them his life, his philosophy, his tales. They found him shrewd, intelligent, a good listener, and above all, courteous. His enemies, though, had other tales to tell. If a man helped the police in any way, as an informer, guide, or tracker, he and his family were no longer safe. The police offered protection, but you couldn't count on the police. What you could count on was Lampion. And this was so true, it became a proverb. The return of Lampion is cruel. He would burn your house, kill your father before your eyes, dig your own grave before he shot you. The stories are endless. Everyone in the Sertão knows one. Courtesy but murder. Murder and courtesy. The people comprehended both, and the oldest ones still remember his dances. Life is hard, he would say. The people need a good time. And when the moon was right and the police at bay, he would invite a small town to a ball, as they called them. He'd hire a guitarist and an accordion player, and with the money he'd taken from the rich, he'd pay for food and plenty of drink and send boys out to the countryside with an invitation. Come to Lampion's ball tonight. Then he and his men would deck themselves in the gold and jewels they'd stolen across the region, and splash themselves with their famous perfume, tie red scarves around their necks, lace gold chains through long black hair, stick jeweled knives into their sashes. The girls from these isolated places would creep in from their silent houses and dance all night with the bandits, hands behind the back, moving forward, moving back, coming closer, and then with a swirl away, almost touching, never touching. Afterwards, the street poets would sing of these girls sitting in their windows waiting for Lampion to come back. But he didn't, because before too long he fell in love with Maria Bonita.
One of his rules was that his men were not to ravage the girls, right?
Oh, no, they never did. Absolutely never. In fact, they didn't even steal. They would ask for things and then take them if the people wouldn't give them, but they never did anything underhanded. Lampion once caught somebody stealing in a back room and he shot the guy. Wow. You know, one of his guys, he said this, you know, we don't have robbers in our band.
And his downfall came about because another group didn't follow those rules as closely.
Didn't follow the rules, exactly. Yeah. A group that, you know, his group got so big that it ended up spawning other groups.
Uh-huh.
And they would meet up every once in a while, you know, as often as they could. But he would send them out. There were a couple people who were natural leaders. One of these was called Corisco, and he was the second most famous bandit. But he wasn't as good a leader as Lampion. And, yeah, you're right. That's just what happened.
Didn't run as tight a ship.
No.
Yeah. So now do you want to read a little bit about Maria Bonita?
Just one last piece about Maria Bonita. This is when she was married to the shoemaker. She spent 6 miserable years married to him from age 16 to 22. And this passage is from right before when she went off with Lampion. One night she lay alone in her hammock wondering about the werewolf who'd come to her cousin's house about a week ago. Her aunt and uncle had walked out to a funeral and the children were there alone, but they were old enough to bring in the goats and to remember to heft the heavy bar across the door. But it almost didn't matter. He almost broke it down anyway. They'd woken to the sound of his howling, his clawing, his panting, and crawled together into the farthest corner and watched the door heave. All night long it went on, the howling and clawing, though once in a while it would let up and they'd hear a commotion among the chickens. But then he'd come back, and the only question was whether the door would hold till dawn. They'd heard that he couldn't stand even one ray of sunshine, and it must have been true, because he was no longer there when their parents came back the next morning into the yard with the dead chickens scattered all around it and the house still locked and barred. The priest came out afterwards with holy water, and everyone came by to stare at the gashes in the door. One old tracker said it was the work of a jaguar, but the children were adamant. It was the wolf man. They'd heard him clearly, even if they hadn't had to see his terrible face. But what would have happened next, she wondered. Not to the children, but to her, if he'd come in there. What would he do? Would there be love before the murder? He was a wolf, but he was a man, too. Which was he more, wolf or man? She walked over to the shutters, closed tight, as everyone's were, every door and shutter in the whole Sertan, shut and barred before nightfall. The nights were filled with danger. Werewolves, bandits, terrors all, to be shut out. But what was she afraid of? Really, what was she afraid of anymore? She threw open the shutters and whispered to the night, I want. But want what? She didn't know. Until the day she saw gun belts on her husband's workbench and knife sheaths 20 inches long.
Because he was doing work for the bandits.
The bandits, yeah.
Yeah.
They'd come into that village. One of the guys had sort of slipped in and brought things. All of their things were leather, and they always needed to be fixed.
Mm-hmm.
So they'd have to. They were all very good leather workers themselves, but occasionally it was a luxury for them to be able to come to a real shoemaker and get their sandals fixed, their gun belts, their knife sheaths, you know, their hats, everything, their horses' gear.
And so even that level of detail is accurate?
It is. Wow. Everything in this book is accurate. It's funny. I have one version that is totally footnoted with all my references. And that's really fun for me to look back and see where everything was.
Wow.
You know, who told me that or where I found, you know, these details.
Wow.
And... It was an amazingly intense story. You know, I was one of the best interviews that I now this one I read because the man was dead long before I went out there was at one point the bandits were able to take captive one of their worst enemies who had pursued them relentlessly to the state of Pernambuco where Lampion had been born. And where his worst enemies lived, his most passionate enemies. And they caught this man. He had been the leader, the general, really, of the Pernambuco forces. And they caught him out at his ranch. and they took him captive. And they planned to kill him. Of course, there was no question that they were going to kill him. But he suggested a huge ransom. And so they thought maybe they'd get the money too. So, but it took a few days. And by the time, after the first day, they had him tied up and he was walking behind their horses. After a few hours of that, they had put him on a horse. By the first night, they had him by the campfire. One of them gave him his bedroll. And by the end of it, saw that they really couldn't keep him anymore because the money hadn't come. They gave him some money to get back home. And
they were really bad guys, weren't they?
He gave the most wonderful interview about them and talked about their excellent strategy and their brilliance and their generosity and their forgiveness. And, it was amazing.
Yeah.
Yeah, so they were...
Well, that's what make them the folk heroes that they are.
That's what made them the folk heroes.
Yeah.
And it's interesting because he had a beautiful young daughter, and she was engaged to a man in Recife, in the capital. And when she heard her father was kidnapped, she tried to get some people to go out there with her with the money. She went to the bank and got the money and was going to drive out in a car that she had. And no one would go with her, not even her fiancé or ex-fiancé, as she told the local news. And she went out by herself. She didn't find her father, but, she was a great, strong, hero.
Well, you're listening to Writers' Voices with Monica and Caroline, and our guest today is Victoria Shore, author of Backlands. Victoria, several times there's references to the church in the parts you read and to kind of a local miracle priest. How intertwined was the church with the bandits?
Oh, the bandits were very religious and superstitious. And in Brazil, the two really go together. In fact, I have to say, I myself have become, fairly superstitious after living down there for 10 years. We never say we're going to do something. We'll say we're planning to do something or hoping to do something. They all wore their medallions. Lampion actually was blessed by, there was a miracle priest called Padre Cicero living in those days. And he, to this day, by the way, every single little house in the Sertão has his picture up on the wall.
Hmm.
And he had, the communion wine had turned to blood under his hand, supposedly, in 1870. And so people believed that. And he lived in a town called Juazeiro, which became and still is a site for pilgrimages throughout the region. Everyone who could would go to that town and get blessed. Lampion had been blessed by the priest, given certain medallions that were specially blessed and good luck. And they prayed every day. They prayed all the time on their knees, day and night, at noon if when they could. They were very religious.
Mm.
And but it was, it was that kind of backlands religion, a very a combination of what we would call superstition, Catholic liturgy, and everyone believed in the werewolf. Now, that story about the werewolf I got from someone in São Paulo who worked for us. She told us about the time the werewolf came to her house when she was a little girl.
Wow.
And, as if it were true, as a true story.
Wow.
Well, there was a werewolf.
They are very religious. They still are very religious. People make the pilgrimages. You go to this town of Juazeiro. You go to the church where Padre Cicero used to be, and then you wear blue afterwards. You go home in blue, with a certain leaf pinned on your shirt. I haven't been there, but I'd really love to go.
Wow,
Todd.
You also earlier had talked about when you were traveling there and not knowing necessarily where you were going to sleep every night, and in the book, when Maria Bonita is thinking about her future and about her life, sometimes she misses having a bed to sleep in.
I know. I mean, I that's where the book, you know, that's what took me into fiction, was sort of all of a sudden really reimagining their lives, you know, what it really would be like. You know, it's one thing to think about how beautiful it is to always be sleeping out under the stars, but then you realize there comes a moment. And I guess maybe I felt it that day looking at that park bench and thinking, you know, it sounds like, what's the problem? It wasn't cold, you know. What's the problem with sleeping out on a park bench? But I really didn't want to, you know. It just, you're so vulnerable. There was just that feeling of what it would be like to always, to never have a bed again, you know.
Yeah.
Never be able to sleep within walls, with a roof. And I think that people, you know, I think toward the end she was quite despondent and tired, exhausted.
No. I'll bet.
Yeah.
So, Victoria, tell us a little bit about how you found a publisher and how this book came to be published.
Oh, gosh. You know, it's so hard these days, isn't it? I mean, it really is. I've been writing for many years, and I've luckily always had a group of friends who would read my work and love it, which is really what kept me going all these years. But I had written another book that a friend in New York showed to his sister, who's a publisher at Knopf. I was published by Norton, but she loved it, and she got me an agent. Not my agent, actually. Now she got me a very fancy agent, and I thought, oh, I'm all set now. This is great. I'm in like Flynn. Well, that agent didn't do anything, and so. Then I met another agent through a friend of mine, an old friend, and she was really enthusiastic about still another book, not this book. So we got together, but we really connected. She, her name is Jane Lahr, and she works with Lynn Delaquadri. And they took this book to Norton, and Norton just finally said yes. So, you know, it is such a process, and you have to have a reason to believe that it's worth doing. You know, I was in despair many, many times, as you can imagine.
So you had three books that were complete and ready for publication.
Yes, yes.
Wow.
Really, I have to say four.
Four.
I've been writing really since my 30s.
Wow.
So I've been writing for 30 years.
And why do you think this is the one that broke through for you?
Went first. I don't know. I guess the stars just lined up for this one. But it was. I think it's because it's a story that has never been told, maybe.
Right.
Mm-hmm. One of my other books, though, is about Joan of Arc. And believe it or not, that's a story that hasn't been told either. It's about the last week of her life. And I found that when I was working. I don't know what possessed me to start researching Joan of Arc when I was living in New York in the 70s. But when I was reading all the primary sources about her trial and rehabilitation in the public library in New York, I realized that no one had told the story of her last week, which to me is the most interesting part of her life.
Wow. I wonder how that got overlooked all these years.
No, I think because a woman hadn't really looked at it.
Aha, mm. Uh-huh.
There you go. We are finding our voices in writing for the first time ever, you know. We're living long enough. You know, Joan of Arc, I came to Joan of Arc almost as a mother to a daughter. Mm. After I did the research when I was living in New York, but the story only came to me about 10 years later when I had a daughter. And I think that's what, I think that women with daughters really haven't been able to pick up the pen until recently.
True.
I think we're bringing a new perspective even to very old stories.
Wow. So is that one going to be published?
I hope so. Hope so. That's the one that got me this agent. She loves it.
Oh, good.
It's called Girl X, because Joan of Arc was actually taken to the stake twice. Nobody knows that. The first time she freaked out. She was 19 years old. She panicked and recanted.
Wow.
Everything. And was supposed to sign her name, but couldn't write, so she signed an X.
Ah.
And that's where my story really starts.
Wow.
Yeah.
And fascinating.
6 days later, they burned her anyway, but they burned a very different person. A grown-up.
So Backlands came out quite recently, right?
Backlands, yeah, came out in mid-May.
Yeah, and what kind of response have you been getting?
Oh, God, it's just been fantastic, you know, because as we said, you know, it's been hard to get things published, and I'm so accustomed to no's, no, that then to get, it started with a really great review from Booklist and from Kirkus, and then to get the New York Times book review, I'm sort of flabbergasted, like, I'm the same. Nothing has changed.
But the world changed.
The world changed. Anyway, it's thrilling. It's wonderful. I am just amazed. And everybody keeps coming up to me and saying, I picked up your book and I couldn't put it down. And it was, you know, I must say it was great last night to have all these Brazilians saying that, because Brazilians are very often resistant to outsiders talking about their history. But this was really great, you know, so I'm thrilled that they like it as well.
That is wonderful.
And, the response has been kind of a dream.
And that really should help your other books
find
a home,
I
would
think. I think that it will.
Yeah. Can you talk about you said there were four altogether. Can you talk about
the other
two? Well, another
book, one of my uncles died, and this is always the sad thing that happens. I reread a letter that he'd written from Europe after World War II. And he talked about my grandfather's brother escaping from Auschwitz.
Oh, my goodness.
Oh, wow.
I'd never heard this story. And they were Czechs. And I started researching it, and it produced, I think, a very intense book. That's the one that the person at Knopf had responded to. So I'm hoping that one might be.
Now, in that case, in that book and the Joan of Arc book, are they both fictionalized also, or are they written as nonfiction?
The Joan of Arc, I consider, again, it's like this. They're all true, but they're fictionalized, because I do go into people's heads.
Right. So it's creative nonfiction.
Creative, I guess. Creative nonfiction. Yes, that's a much better word for it.
Yeah.
Say, I was taken aback when I saw a novel on the cover of this book, because I didn't think of it as that. But
right.
Yeah.
And then your fourth one?
The fourth one is a series of short stories about expatriate life in Brazil.
Oh, interesting.
And they're all true, too, but they're unbelievable. You know, I'm really only interested in things that happened. I'm not interested in making things up.
Well, they say truth is stranger than fiction.
It is. And as Scheherazade said, there's nothing so strange it can't be true.
Yeah. Now,
I found this to be true in living in Brazil. I all these amazing short stories. So, and that, I think, is the next book to be published.
Really? Wow.
Was Brazil colonized by Portugal? Is that why they speak Portuguese?
It was. And we're lucky that they did, because they didn't kill the Indians the way they did in the rest of South America. They married them.
Uh-huh.
And so you get this Brazilian mix of people that is unique, really, in the world. They're very different, and they're really wonderful. Very, very special.
Wow.
Yeah.
We could write a book about that, too.
Yes, exactly. Oh, gosh.
Yeah, it doesn't seem like you're going to run out of material.
No, soon. I really want to write another book about something that happened down there.
Right. You mentioned that earlier in the show.
Same region, just a little bit earlier.
Yeah, that sounds...
Really, it's really a book that was written about by the Brazilian, I would call him the Brazilian Tolstoy. And people up here really don't know about him. And so I'm really looking forward to doing that.
Well, I would say that people up here don't know much about South America at all.
No, but I think as we learn more, we're a whole new world is going to open for us. And South America is just—it's in our backyard. It's a wonderful place to travel. It's interesting. It's beautiful. And I think we're going to be more and more interested in it.
I think so too.
Yeah, I agree.
Yeah. Well, we're almost out of time. We just have a couple minutes left.
I want to say one thing to Iowa. I once went to a workshop at the in Iowa City at the Writers' Workshop, and I was just—I fell in love with Iowa. In love, I was—I really didn't want to leave. It was springtime, and the peonies were out, and I was lucky enough to meet some Mennonites, so I went out to their farm, and I mean, and went to church with them Sunday morning with the singing, and
Wow,
loved it so much, so much. I'm from Ohio originally, and I hadn't had the Midwest feeling for so long, and I just found myself in heaven, really.
Well, you should come back to Iowa, and
I will.
You know, really, you should look into teaching a course at the University of at the Summer Writing Workshop.
Yes.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Oh,
and
yes.
I would come and take it. You know, they. I don't know if that's what you were. Were you at the Summer Writing Workshop?
No, it was a. It was taught by Frank Conroy, who I must say wasn't. You know, actually hated my work. It was funny. When the class loved it, so that, you know, it was really a thing. It was in the spring.
Okay, well, check out the Summer Writing Workshop because, you know, I think you'd be a really great fit for
teaching
a class
love to
there.
Do that.
Yeah.
Absolutely love to.
Well, thank you so much.
Iowa. Well, thank you so much for having me.
Yeah, this has been a great pleasure.
So how do we get this book?
Oh.
Where do we find this book?
It's called Backlands, and it's in all the bookstores or online at you know, all the online sites.
Amazon, Barnes & Noble.
Okay.
Yeah, Barnes & Noble. Yeah. And I hate to say Amazon.
and also available probably at independent bookstores. If it's not there, you can order it.
Yeah, exactly. All the independent bookstores have it, or at least the ones that a lot of them do, and they it's easy to order.
Backlines by Victoria Shore. Yeah.
And I do have a website. It's www.victoriashorr.com. And that's fun because they're pictures of the houses of the Backlands that my friend took there. So it gives you a little bit of a feel.
Oh, awesome. I'm going to have to check that out.
They're beautiful pictures.
Well, thanks so much for being with us. We're out of time. Mom, do you have some final words of wisdom for us?
Henry Ford once said, whether you think you can or think you can't, you're right.
And
brilliant.
See you next week on Writers' Voices. Writers' Voices with Monica and Caroline is a production of KRUU-LP 100.1 FM, produced by Monica Hadley and James Moore. Archives available on KRUU-FM.com and writersvoices.com.